Good morning. Millions of people who rely on SNAP benefits to feed themselves and their families do not have them today. After two court rulings, it's not clear when the program would resume. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. New York City voters finish deciding tomorrow who leads their city. I'm Steve Inske.
And I'm Michelle Martin. People from around the country are coming in to see Zoran Mamdani. Andrew Cuomo is being helped by super PACs funded by billionaires. Also, the former top military prosecutor in Israel is under arrest days after she admitted to leaking a video showing Israeli soldiers abusing a Palestinian detainee. It is Monday, November 3rd. On this day in 1992, Carol Moseley Braun became the first African-American woman elected to the U.S. Senate. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. This is day 34 of the federal government shutdown. President Trump says he won't negotiate with Democrats, whom he described as, quote, crazed lunatics. But the shutdown also means a cutoff in federal money for food support. Today is the deadline for the Trump administration to tell two federal judges whether it will comply with their court orders to continue to fund the food program, known as SNAP. The pause on SNAP benefits has left nonprofits around the country looking for ways to help. One Dallas nonprofit called Our Giving Kitchen made about 700 meals this weekend. From member station KERA, James Hartley has more.
Co-founder Oliver Steinberg says that's hundreds more than they usually make. The Kitchen is a Jewish nonprofit that accepts volunteers and offers meals regardless of religious affiliation. Every meal was handed out in Dallas's Fair Park area before the group of volunteers headed home Sunday.
Maybe the SNAP program being paused right now has impacted some families and some people. And it's just, you know, today's a very strong day to go and give back to the community.
He says the hope Sunday was to offset the impacts families in Dallas might feel from a disruption in SNAP benefits. For NPR News, I'm James Hartley in Dallas, Texas.
The government shutdown is also threatening federal aid for home heating assistance. Mark Wolf leads the National Energy Assistance Directors Association. He warns that people on low incomes who need help for heating bills may face terrible choices.
There were middle-income people are complaining about their average electric bill going up by 10%. They can pay the bill. But for a low-income family, you have to give up something else to pay it. And so it's a very different situation.
He says low-income Americans who need heat and food aid are finding that federal support is potentially heading toward a cliff. Israel says it has identified the bodies of three Israeli soldiers killed on October 7, 2023, and then taken into Gaza by Hamas-led militants. The Red Cross transferred the bodies from Hamas to Israel last night. It's the latest exchange of remains as part of a U.S.-brokered ceasefire. NPR's Lauren Frayer has more from Tel Aviv.
A statement from the Israeli Prime Minister's office says forensic tests confirm the latest three bodies returned to Israel are those of Israeli soldiers, including that of Omer Nutra, a New York native who served as a tank platoon commander in the Israeli military. President Trump told reporters on Air Force One that he spoke to Nutra's parents.
They're thrilled in one sense, but in another sense, obviously, it's not too great.
In exchange for these three bodies, Israel is now expected to release 45 bodies of Palestinians it has been holding. A Hamas spokesperson says this latest handover shows the group's firm commitment to complete these exchanges as quickly as possible. Lauren Frayer, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
This is NPR. The Taliban say that at least 20 people have been killed by a powerful earthquake in northern Afghanistan. The U.S. Geological Survey says the quake's magnitude was 6.3. Hundreds of people are reported injured. It's difficult to get information out of Afghanistan. Some unverified videos are showing collapsed homes. Sleep scientists say that this weekend's switch to standard time offers people more light in the morning. It can have positive effects on our health. But NPR's Allison Aubrey reports the time change also disrupts people's routines and circadian rhythms.
Exposure to morning light helps to reset the master clock in your brain and serves as an external cue to wake up. Scientists at the Salk Institute are studying the impacts of time on health and mood. Researcher Emily Manoogian says sticking to a consistent bedtime, mealtime, and exercise time can be beneficial.
Exercise is a stimulatory cue to tell your body you should be awake. So exercising like just before bed is something that will make it hard to fall asleep.
By tracking the timing of your daily activities from when you eat, sleep, and exercise, people can tweak daily habits to align with their body clocks to promote good health. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
The Los Angeles Dodgers will hold a parade today to celebrate their World Series win this weekend. The Dodgers beat the Toronto Blue Jays 5-4 in the decisive seventh game of the series. It went 11 innings. The Dodgers will parade late this morning in downtown L.A. Afterwards, the team says the party will move indoors, Dodger Stadium. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
On November 3rd, 1968, Jimi Hendrix, the guitar god of psychedelic rock, descended on the Minneapolis Auditorium in a flowery shirt and pink pants. He and his band, The Experience, set the tone for the evening by dedicating a song to the narcotics and plainclothes cops and any other bastards who happened to be in the audience. The audience pushed forward on a surge of adrenaline. Finally, the MC coaxed everyone back to their seats until an impish Hendrix pointed his tongue at a girl. The place went wild. The Star Tribune's critic was not so impressed. He said the Jimi Hendrix show was billed as an experience, and that's a good name for it. It was an experience, an undesirable one. 2 years later, May 3rd, 1970, Hendrix played the other side of the river. The St. Paul concert is still around as a bootleg, but sadly, Hendrix died 4 months after his St. Paul gig.
Ooh, foxy lady.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Millions of Americans are trying to figure out how they will eat this month. The National Food Aid Program, known as SNAP, ran out of federal money this weekend. The Trump administration had said it would not put more money into the program, citing the federal government shutdown.
Two federal judges ordered the administration to use emergency money to keep SNAP afloat on Friday, but it's unclear how quickly the administration will act. Over the next few minutes, we're going to hear SNAP recipients and the former head of the agency that oversees the program. We begin with the latest on restoring funding.
NPR's Joe Hernandez has been following this, and he's with us now. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning.
So will the government begin distributing money for SNAP benefits this week or not?
Well, we still don't know. The U.S. Department of Agriculture manages the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. The USDA's website says, quote, the well has run dry and blames Democrats for the government shutdown. Then you have President Trump posting on social media that he would fund the program if his administration got direction from the federal courts on how to do that. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent was on CNN's State of the Union on Sunday and suggested SNAP funding could resume within days. Here's what he said.
President Trump wants to make sure that people get their food benefits.
So it could be done by Wednesday.
Could be.
And that's because, as you mentioned, there are at least two federal lawsuits pushing the Trump administration to restart SNAP. Judges in both cases have ordered the administration to resume payments using emergency funds. In one of those cases in Rhode Island, the judge ordered the government to either make full SNAP payments by Monday or partial payments by Wednesday.
So if the USDA does have these emergency funds, why haven't they been used to pay for SNAP benefits this month?
Well, the Trump administration has argued that it's not legal for them to use these contingency funds for regular SNAP benefits. They say that money is meant more for situations like natural disasters. But a coalition of Democratic state officials behind one of the lawsuits argues that the government has to use those emergency funds and that if SNAP benefits stop, it will lead to greater food insecurity across the country, which state governments will then be left to manage on their own. Now, some states are already putting up state money to try to keep benefits going. going, but that will probably only last days or weeks and won't be enough to replace a national federal government program. And just to give you a sense of how vast a program that is, nearly 42 million Americans rely on SNAP.
Okay, so recognizing what you just said, that some states are trying to fill in the gap, at least for a little bit. But having said that, how is the lapse in funding affecting those 42 million people?
Yeah, it's really a historic moment for this program, which dates back to the Great Depression and has not been disrupted like this before. NPR has reported that food banks across the U.S. are already seeing a spike in demand. Jill Dixon runs the Food Depot. That's a food bank serving northern New Mexico, and says this is really uncharted territory.
The idea that SNAP benefits wouldn't continue has never really been on the table before. There's no history for that to have occurred. So I think that that caught everyone by surprise and is incredibly disheartening and fear-inducing.
And Dixon says people are starting to stock up on food now. At one recent distribution the Food Depot held, where they typically have fewer than 100 families in attendance, they had 150 show up.
Okay, before we let you go, even once SNAP does get funded again, there are still some major changes coming to the program. What are those?
That's right. And that's due to some provisions in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act that President Trump signed in July. Things like the age limit going up, certain immigrants such as refugees will lose access to the program, and some states may have to start contributing their own money to SNAP benefits for the first time in history.
That is NPR's Joe Hernandez. Joe, thank you.
You're welcome.
People who rely on SNAP benefits include Brandy Monovic.
I've cut down eating three meals a day to eating one meal a day.
She is a single mom in Colorado, and here's what one meal a day does to her.
I don't have as much energy. I'm tired. I'm hungry a lot. I drink water to try to help with the hunger pain.
Two of her three children have autism. One has chronic seizures and migraines.
My oldest, he just keeps on saying, I don't understand why I can't eat. And then my middle child is causing her to have more migraines. And then my youngest, she's just more, like, agitated, keeps on crying.
So she's looking for other ways to feed her family.
I've been trying to find a job, which can be hard with me having three disabled kids, trying to find care for them.
Another SNAP recipient, Susan from Buffalo, New York, receives disability assistance as well as those benefits. She did not want us to use her full name because she doesn't want people to know she relies on the benefits.
I'm afraid it's going to kill me. I have other medical conditions that will be affected by poor nutrition. And, you know, I still have things to offer. I'm not ready to die for political reasons.
Susan is organizing contributions on social media to help support her fellow senior living residents. But she says she knows those resources are limited.
That's supposed to be what our government is for, to promote the general welfare. And that means everybody, whether they're on one side or the other of the political aisle. This is supposed to be for taking care of people.
Some SNAP recipients on this Monday. Let's turn to somebody who knows how the program works. Cindy Long spent decades working at the Department of Agriculture under Republican and Democratic administrations and ended her career there as the head of the agency that oversees government nutrition programs, including SNAP. Welcome to the program. Good morning.
Good morning.
I just want to note the benefits just expired over the weekend. What do you think about when you hear somebody, as we just did, who says, I have immediately cut from three meals a day to one?
Well, I want to say it's shocking, and it is shocking because we have never seen SNAP benefits cut off like this. But on the other hand, it's not shocking because the research has been clear for a long time that SNAP helps people avoid food insecurity, and they rely on it for their basic needs. So, you know, what do people expect other than people going hungry when SNAP benefits dry up?
And I want to underline also, we heard a single mom there who said, my kids are also affected. Is that normal if we look across this program?
Absolutely. The research shows that parents, the adults in a household, try to protect kids first. And so they're the ones that will skip meals, but that the food insecurity can flow down to children as well when things are very tight. And having no SNAP benefits certainly equates to things being very tight.
And I'm thinking about the common study that finds that people who faced a $400 emergency would immediately be out of money. They would not have the money on hand. I suppose we're talking here about people who just do not have a lot of extra food in the pantry or anyplace else.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the reason people are on SNAP is because they are, you know, economically struggling. So when SNAP benefit go away, they have to scramble to find food from other places. So they're not only going to have to think about, you know, skipping meals, going hungry, but also trading off, you know, am I going to pay for my prescription this month?
Yeah.
Because I need the money to buy food.
So we heard from a woman there named Susan who said she doesn't want to give her full name because she doesn't want people to know she depends on this program. And that immediately makes me think, 42 million people, this might be my neighbor, right? This might be several people at my kid's school. How do I find out and how can I help?
Well, I think how can you help is really the key question, which is, and you know, you've already discussed the fact that demand at food banks and other kinds of emergency food support is going to be going through the roof. So my advice to folks who want to help is to seek those places out in your community. Every community has food banks, food pantries, other kinds of support, and provide to those entities that are going to be seeing, you know, soaring demand if they haven't already.
Let me ask about a complaint that is commonly made about government benefits. The complaint is that people are just getting free stuff. They don't really need it, that they could support themselves another way, and instead they're using taxpayer funds. That's the complaint. Are there some recipients of SNAP benefits who are working jobs, who are doing work, but are just not making enough to support their families?
Oh, absolutely. Significant proportions of SNAP households work. 70% of SNAP households include either children or the elderly or the disabled. But again, substantial proportions are working. You know, I can't tell you how many people I've met over my career that have talked about how SNAP was a lifeline when they lost a job because of the economy or because, the worker had to take care of a sick child or a sick parents. And it was a bridge that got them through a very difficult time. So the stereotype of folks being on the program for the long term because they would prefer to sit on a couch and not work, in my experience, is just not at all accurate.
So let's check the political debate here. The administration has said we cannot legally spend this money. A couple of federal judges have disagreed and said, actually, you should get started with this money, with these emergency funds. Are you familiar with the emergency mechanisms here, given that this hasn't happened before? Did you ever have to contemplate anything like this? And do you think the administration should easily be able to start this program back up?
Yeah, we've unfortunately been through a number of government shutdowns in the last several decades. I was at USDA for all of those. And what I can tell you is these specific SNAP contingency funds, while they never had to be used for benefits before, they were always considered available. They were part of the planning as a last resort. They would be the place that USDA would go to fund this program. So when I first heard that the administration was taking this interpretation that they couldn't be used, it was extraordinary. And it seems that the courts have agreed with the prior interpretation that no, indeed, these funds are available and should be used.
Is this something you could walk in on a Monday morning and fix, or is it going to take a while to fire things back up?
Well, there's going to be some process. The good news is the federal government can very quickly move the funds to the states. The states then have to sort out with a contractor how to get the benefits out quickly, because we're already behind schedule. And to the extent that the benefits need to be adjusted to account for the fact that there's not a full amount of funding available, that may take a little time. So I believe that when things get turned back on, it will probably vary a little bit from state to state, but the feds can move fast.
Good. Cindy Long, formerly of the Department of Agriculture, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Debuting on October 16th, KEXE brings you a brand new podcast, Season Watch, exploring the seasonal wonders of life in northern Minnesota. Voices like Charlie Mitchell, John Latimer, and our listeners. Find it on most podcast platforms. Season Watch is a podcast for those who are curious about the changes in nature.
Comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate, at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Israel's former top military lawyer is under arrest because she leaked video footage showing Israeli soldiers abusing a Palestinian detainee. She went missing on Sunday night, and there were fears for her life, but she now is in custody. NPR's Daniel Estrin is covering the story from Tel Aviv. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Steve.
I guess we should note at the beginning we're going to be discussing graphic details of alleged abuse over the next 4 minutes or so. Where does the story begin?
It begins last summer. It's in the middle of the Gaza war. A group of soldiers was arrested and charged with abusing a Palestinian detainee at an Israeli detention center where they were guarding detainees. Now, according to the indictment, the Palestinian detainee was blindfolded, his hands and legs were bound, and the soldiers beat him and stabbed his bottom with a sharp object that tore his rectum, and he needed multiple surgeries. This was the most prominent alleged war crime that Israeli authorities prosecuted from the Gaza war.
And what happened after the soldiers were charged?
Wow. Far-right Israeli lawmakers and demonstrators stormed the base where the military court is. They stormed the detention facility where the soldiers were being held. They were coming to these soldiers' defense. Some of them were defending the soldiers' actions, saying that they were justified in the wake of the October 7th Hamas attack in 2023. And others were actually accusing the military's advocate general of faking the allegations against these soldiers. So after that, Israeli TV got hold of leaked security camera footage allegedly showing the soldiers in the act. The new twist here, Steve, is that a few days ago, the military's top lawyer, Yifat Tomer Yerushalmi, admitted that she was the one who leaked that footage to Israeli TV to show that these weren't fake charges. Now, you're not supposed to leak evidence in an ongoing case, according to Israeli law, and she had allegedly lied about trying to find the source of the leak. So she resigned on Friday, and it sparked a major firestorm here. Israel's hard right leaders are blaming her for leaking the footage and making Israel look bad, and even Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called it perhaps Israel's worst public relations attack in its history.
Okay, this is very interesting. So the focus here is on the leak of the images of the abuse, not so much the abuse itself, but then what happened with her disappearing?
Yeah, she went missing Sunday evening, and authorities went searching for her. Israeli media reported she was feared to have died by suicide, but then she was found alive, and she's been taken into police custody for leaking the footage, and she remains in custody today.
Okay, so clearly you're going to be covering this story again. We're going to be hearing about this again. This story is nowhere near its end. But why is it significant for Israel that this is the debate right now?
I think the takeaway here, Steve, is to look at the far-right pressure in Israel. It's backed by the Israeli government, and it's focusing on targeting the prosecution of this alleged war crime and not the alleged war crime itself. The military's advocate general, its top lawyer, has a main job to give legal backing to Israel's military actions in Gaza and to investigate when the army allegedly commits crimes and to show the world that Israel can investigate itself at wartime. But there does appear to be a chilling effect here with all of this pressure against what she's done exposing the evidence of this abuse. Israel's newspaper Haaretz is reporting anonymous military officials saying that the pressure against her for investigating this abuse case was so high that she allegedly has not prosecuted even arguably more egregious alleged war crimes like Israeli military killings of medical staff in Gaza, of journalists and of aid workers.
NPR's Daniel Estrin in Tel Aviv. Thanks so much for your reporting, as always, Daniel.
You're welcome.
Jury selection is starting this morning in a case that has come to symbolize how many in the nation's capital feel about the Trump administration surge here. It involves a man who threw a sandwich at a federal officer in D.C. this August. He has pled not guilty to an assault charge. NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson has this report.
The image of a man in a pink shirt hurling a foot-long sub is all over the place. He's on billboards, T-shirts, and outdoor Halloween decorations. Today, the man himself is set to appear in federal court on a charge of assaulting a federal officer. The story begins the night of August 10th. That's when camera footage captured Sean Charles Dunn calling officers racists and fascists before he tossed a hoagie at one of them and ran away.
You see these fascists right here.
Dunn is an Air Force veteran. He worked at the Justice Department until he was fired by Attorney General Pam Bondi, who called him an example of the deep state. A grand jury in D.C. refused to indict him on a felony charge. Instead, prosecutors are moving ahead with a less serious misdemeanor case. Dunn says he's being singled out because of his criticism of the Trump administration. He volunteered to surrender to authorities, but his lawyer says at least 20 federal agents showed up at his apartment to put him in handcuffs. Later, the White House posted a slick video of the arrest.
The prosecutors really seem out to get this guy.
That's Paul Butler, a law professor at Georgetown University. He says the disparaging remarks from Justice Department officials and the fact Dunn lost his job may be beside the point.
Those facts might make Mr. Dunn a more sympathetic defendant to the jury, but they're not pertinent to whether he threw a sandwich at a law enforcement officer, which is the principal issue the jury will be asked to determine.
The trial scheduled to last about 2 days. Dunn's being represented by two former federal public defenders. They've worked on cases involving the promoter of the Troubled Fire Festival and terrorism suspects. U.S. Attorney Jeanine Pirro told reporters last week she's hoping the jury in this case has an open mind.
No one should come in with preconceived notions or feelings that are going to impact the way they accept and receive the evidence.
Prospective jurors will be asked whether they have such strong views about President Trump and his safe and beautiful task force for D.C. that they can't be fair. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
For nearly two centuries, Eliza Monroe Hay, the daughter of President James Monroe, lay forgotten in an unmarked grave in Paris.
She was a woman ahead of her time. She probably made her opinions known, and I think people didn't know how to deal with that.
I'm Scott Detrow. How a retired school teacher helped bring the first daughter home on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered starting at 4 o'clock today on KAXC with your local host, Heidi Holton. Good morning. It is 529. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show. In just a few moments, our daily dose of phenology, John Latimer, looks back at his nature notes for this date. Weather today, mostly sunny, highs near 50, breezy west winds. Mostly clear tonight, lows near 30, and for tomorrow, partly sunny, highs in the low 50s. Election day is tomorrow. 13 school districts in rural northern Minnesota are asking residents to support referendums in special elections this year. The KAXE news team has gathered information on these referendums and details on how to vote. Find that at kaxe.org. Plans are underway for the 20th annual Back to Basics event on February 7th at Pine River Backus School. They are looking for presenters and vendors who are passionate about sustainable living. Proposals are due November 14th. Find more information at happydancingturtle.org. Kutaska Community Action offers free lunch every Wednesday from 11 to 1 at their Circles of Support office located across from Treasure Bay Printing on Northeast 4th Street in Grand Rapids. They also offer a food pantry from 11 to 2 Monday through Thursday. The Arrowhead Library System hosts local author Susan Hawkinson with Tales of Lumberjacks, Settlers, and Lumber Barons. Now through November 14th, find a full schedule at alslib.info. Coming up at 7:20, events up north, Sarah Bignell and I will take a closer look at what's going on throughout the region this week. You can also find a comprehensive list at kaxe.org. Look for events up north and let us know what's happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxe.org. It's time for our daily dose of phenology. Here's John Latimer.
On today's date, November 3rd, 1991, most of northern Minnesota, in fact, most of the state of Minnesota, is just beginning to dig out from what was then called the storm of the century. We received 15 inches of snow here in Grand Rapids. In Duluth, they had 37 inches of snow, and down in Minneapolis, 25 inches of snow. All on a snowstorm that began on the 31st of October and truly was still snowing on the 3rd of November. This was a record-breaking snow by every measure. And many, many, many animals and humans were caught out and really weren't quite ready for winter quite that early. I had observations of robins and ruffed grouse sharing the apple trees in my yard. And many of those robins, I'm sure, were thinking, why on earth did I stay here this long?
Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Chapter, offering Medicare advice to seniors nationwide this enrollment period and working to find the plans that best fit their needs. Advisors are available by dialing #250 and saying the keyword Medicare Help. And from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere. At uma.com/NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. More than 730,000 New York City voters have already cast their ballots for mayor, a huge number for a non-presidential election. There is a lot at stake in this race, leadership of the largest city in the U.S., but also a fight over the future of the Democratic Party. Over this last weekend of campaigning, frontrunner Zohran Mamdani has been fending off increasingly intense attacks from his chief rival, former Governor Andrew Cuomo. With the final day of voting tomorrow, we're joined by Gwen Hogan. She works for the local news outlet, The City, and also by NPR's Brian Mann. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Michelle.
So, Gwen, I'm going to start with you. You've been on the campaign trail with Mamdani. What are you seeing?
Big crowds, lots of energy. I was at this rally over the weekend. Mamdani was greeting hundreds of volunteer canvassers in Queens. Some had traveled from across the country to come knock on doors in these final days of the election.
Your next mayor, Zohran Mamdani.
This is a campaign that's amassed more than 100,000 volunteers. They're knocking on doors all over the city. And over the weekend, Mamdani was seemingly everywhere. He was trick-or-treating with kids Friday night. He went to six different nightclubs on Saturday night, and he cheered on runners at the New York City Marathon on Sunday. He's really giving off this tireless energy in the final days of his campaign.
And Brian, you were with Cuomo over the weekend. What did you see?
Yeah, Michelle, much more low energy. Cuomo's 67, so he hasn't been out at nightclubs. He did canvass over the weekend. His crowds were a lot smaller. But, you know, Cuomo's been a fixture in New York politics for decades and still has deep support, especially in the Black and Jewish communities. I spoke with Shireen France at a Cuomo event in Queens on Saturday.
I think he's more experienced. The other guy, he's younger, and I don't think he has the experience. And I don't think it's the right choice right now.
One thing worth mentioning, Cuomo's been helped at the close of this campaign by tens of millions of dollars of super PAC ads, some supporting him, some attacking Mamdani. So while the energy on the street tilts towards Mamdani, Cuomo is benefiting from this deluge of ad spending funded in large part by a handful of billionaires.
Okay, so two very different campaigns. What about the messages? What kinds of closing arguments are you each hearing?
Well, really, from Cuomo, it's a message of fear. He's been saying Mamdani would make the city less safe. He's saying Mamdani's democratic socialism would scare away businesses. Really, the tone was grim when I was with him in Queens. And Gwen, my sense is that what you were hearing when you were with Mamdani was pretty different.
Yeah, that's right, Brian. Mamdani does always take a beat to fend off these attacks, but he's really stayed on message in these final days. It's that message of making New York City more affordable, promising to freeze the rent for the city's 1 million rent-stabilized tenants, making the city's buses faster and free, and providing universal childcare. And for a lot of the voters I've been talking to, that message of affordability is resonating.
Okay, so along with affordability, though, this campaign has included accusations of Islamophobia and anti-Semitism, and how has this escalated?
You know, if Mamdani wins, he'll be the city's first Muslim mayor. And in late October, Cuomo went on this conservative talk show, and the host said Mamdani would be cheering if another 9/11-style terror attack happened. Cuomo didn't push back and said, I'm quoting here, that's another problem. There are also these attack ads attempting to associate Mamdani with, quote, jihad on NYC. Over the weekend, Mamdani was speaking to this large crowd, many of whom were Muslim and of South Asian descent. He asked people to raise their hands if they've ever been called a terrorist, and a lot of hands went up. Mamdani went on to predict more bigotry and racism from Cuomo's allies in the coming days.
And our answer to that is a vision of a city where all of us belong.
And Michelle, I was there over the weekend when Andrew Cuomo was asked about these accusations of Islamophobia and bigotry in his campaign. He pushed back. He said Mamdani hasn't done enough to support Israel and the city's Jewish residents.
His verbiage with the Jewish community has been highly offensive to the Jewish community. If you don't realize that, then you haven't been in this city.
This really has been a flashpoint in this race. It's also roiled the Democratic Party nationally. A September poll by Siena found most New York voters favor Mamdani's position on the Israel-Palestinian conflict, but more than 1,000 U.S. rabbis have signed a letter condemning Mamdani's rhetoric.
You know, there's a third candidate in this race, Republican Curtis Sliwa. Has he been a factor?
Well, in a way, he has been a big factor. Yeah, Sliwa's been a fixture in the city for years. He founded a neighborhood safety group called the Guardian Angels. And while he's running in third place in this heavily Democratic city, he's made it harder for Cuomo to really square off one-on-one against Mamdani. Cuomo's hoped to win a lot of Republican votes, and there was pressure on Sliwa to drop out, but he's refused.
And Sliwa's run for mayor before and lost in a landslide. But he says Republican voters, they don't want Cuomo or Mamdani as their next mayor. Sliwa said Cuomo's the one who should drop out, not him.
I want to go back to one of the things we talked about at the beginning of this conversation, the contrast in this race between excitement for Mamdani versus Cuomo's experience. So how are the candidates talking about that?
Yeah, this is one of Cuomo's big arguments. He says he has the deep experience in government needed to run this city. He wasn't just governor, remember, he was also a state attorney general. He served as housing secretary in the Clinton administration. And his resume does include some progressive legislation here in New York, including prison reform, strict gun control law, and legalization of same-sex marriage.
But Cuomo resigned as New York State governor after a sexual harassment scandal in 2021, and he's faced criticism for his handling of the COVID pandemic. He denies those allegations, but his resume hasn't given him the boost he's looking for. Mamdani, meanwhile, has said what he lacks in experience, he'll make up for in integrity, and he's promising to surround himself with experienced civil servants. But clearly, this is a big question voters will answer tomorrow, and it's a really pivotal moment in New York City. We're facing funding cuts from Trump's federal government. Do people want someone like Mamdani with new and different ideas for New York City, or someone like Cuomo, who's been a fixture in the state's politics for decades?
Okay, before we let you go, Brian, I have one more question for you. Mamdani won the Democratic primary, which is why Cuomo is running as an independent. Does this say something about Cuomo and his ambitions, or does this say something about the Democratic Party writ large?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question, and it's complicated. You know, the excitement Mamdani's generated in this race does thrill a lot of Democrats, especially younger voters, not just here, but around the country. He's emerged really as a national figure. But Mamdani's embrace of the socialist label makes a lot of more centrist Democratic leaders nervous. Many New York Democrats, Michelle, refused to endorse him. Others held off and have offered only lukewarm support. A huge age divide in all of this. And what we've been hearing on the campaign trail is younger voters are much more skeptical of capitalism. They're much more critical of Israel. So, you know, if Mamdani is the next mayor of America's largest city, he's going to have a big bully pulpit to talk about a much younger, more left-leaning version of the Democratic Party.
That is NPR's Brian Mann, along with Gwen Hogan from The City. Thank you both so much.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thanks, Michelle.
Long live the world trade. Long live the king, yo. I'm from the Empire State. That's
This is NPR News.
You should give as you are able because the need is immediate.
Longtime KAXE contributor and Minnesota Star Tribune columnist Aaron Brown. We talked about recent cuts to public media.
It's the people here who make it go. If you want a nice, independent, completely northern Minnesota media source that isn't beholden to anybody else, you have to be willing to put in a little bit of money. This is the time. This is the moment when we have to make decisions about what really is important to our community and to ourselves.
I'm Jennifer Barr. Give right now at KAXE.org. Thank you for your support. It's 5:42. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on People Powered KAXE. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Barr. We'll have more ahead from Morning Edition from National Public Radio coming up just after 7 o'clock, a special edition of the Up North Report, local news from our region. You can also find lots of local news stories and conversations at our website, kaxe.org. Mostly sunny today, highs near 50, breezy west winds up to 25 miles per hour, mostly clear overnight, lows near 30, and tomorrow, partly sunny with highs in the low 50s. The Itasca Curling Club in Grand Rapids offers nightly Learn to Curl sessions all this week. You can drop in from 6 to 7:30 any evening tonight through Friday to learn the sport of curling. Bring in clean sneakers and wear comfortable clothes. Central Lakes College invites the community to its next Cultural Thursday event at noon this Thursday, November 6th, at the Chalberg Theater on the Brainerd campus. Author and social worker Julie Jo Larson will highlight the power of storytelling to strengthen communities. And the Bemidji High School Theater Department presents The Addams Family, a musical comedy, November 6th, 7th, and 8th, 7 p.m. at the school's auditorium. Find a ticket link on Facebook under Bemidji High School Theater. And the Virginia Public Library has a genealogy assistance program the second Thursday of the month, 4 p.m. Whether you are just starting out or fine-tuning your research, all are welcome.
NPR comes from this station and from UKG, committed to making work, work. Their HR, pay, and workforce management tools strive to help business leaders build trust and empower their people. More at ukg.com/work. From Fidelity Investments, a dedicated advisor can help build a flexible wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. President Trump says the Pentagon is preparing for military action in Nigeria. We should use the president's exact words here on social media. He said the U.S. military would go in, quote, guns a-blazing. The president went on to say, quote, if we attack, it will be fast, vicious, and sweet, just like the terrorist thugs attack our cherished Christians. As we have reported over the years on NPR, there are big Islamist militant groups in Nigeria, but the president's own envoy says they kill more Muslims than Christians in a country that is about evenly split between the two faiths. NPR's Emmanuel Akinmotu is in Lagos. Hey there, Emmanuel.
Hi, good morning.
What's the background here?
You know, for years, there's been this pretty dogged campaign by U.S. and international evangelical groups who obviously are a key part of Trump's base. And they've been warning about what they call a Christian genocide. And, you know, that's in the context of Nigeria, which is roughly evenly divided between Christians who are a majority in the south and Muslims who are a majority in the north.
Right.
And then in the last few months, there have been these prominent U.S. figures in the U.S., like Bill Maher, who started criticizing protests against Israel by saying protesters are ignoring other crises, like in Sudan and in Nigeria. And what this leans on is the fact that it's been a pretty brutal 15-year period for Nigeria just because of the scale of rampant insecurity.
Okay, so there's politics here, but there's also a real story. There is insecurity in the country. Is it a campaign against Christians specifically?
Well, this is what these arguments have kind of like focused on. And the curious thing is, just a few days before Trump's statement, his envoy on Arab and African affairs, Massad Boulos, he pretty much contradicted what Trump said.
We even know that Boko Haram and ISIS are killing more Muslims than Christians. So people are suffering from all sorts of backgrounds. This is not specifically targeted about one group or the other.
The Nigerian government have made a similar argument, saying that the data shows attacks by Islamist groups like Boko Haram and ISIS or by militant groups are actually less about religion and more about geography and where they operate. But a common response to that is that the data doesn't capture everything and that attacks with religious aspects are sometimes flatly reported as communal clashes.
Oh, that's very interesting. So we might not have the very best data. But I'm also listening here and realizing that if you say it's strictly Muslims against Christians, it divides the whole country. Whereas if you realize it is violence, it's something you can gather a big majority against. So what are some of the important factors here?
Yeah, exactly. You know, earlier this year, and you know, a kind of key part of this is looking into the types of violence that are happening that is animating these claims. You know, earlier this year, I went to a part of Nigeria that's really been a focus. It's a town in the breadbasket central region of Nigeria that has fertile farmland. And the state's called Benue. It's overwhelmingly Christian. And there have been these disputes over land between Christians and farmers. And, you know, it was really horrific. We saw 160 people died, were killed, shot, hacked to death. There were Christian prayer books littered on the ground. But when we spoke to victims, what they said over and over again, that this wasn't about faith. It was about their land. And that was the primary explanation for the violence they were suffering.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. NPR's Emmanuel Akimoto in Lagos, Nigeria. Thanks, as always, for your reporting. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve.
You hear the world on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
That was Jim Miller doing Alligator Man at a 1978 Known Only Locally concert for KAXE. I'm Christy Miller, and I've been a member since 1977, and with husband Jim Miller, Gary Brusty, and Miriam Tell, Known Only Locally played many benefit concerts through the decades. I strongly urge you to donate to this people-powered radio station. We absolutely must keep KAXE, KBXE going. That's all there is to it. Text DONATE to 218-326-1234. Or go online to KAXE.org.
Thanks and good night.
Thank you. We'll see you at the Jack Pine Jamboree next Monday.
President Trump said last night he wants to fix Obamacare, but he didn't say how, with people soon set to pay much more for health coverage.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Ninja One, helping organizations simplify endpoint management to automate IT and strengthen security all from one platform. More at ninjaone.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. The government shutdown is about to tie a shutdown in 2018-2019 for longest ever. Republicans want to vote to reopen without addressing Affordable Care Act premiums set to skyrocket. Last night, the president weighed in. Here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer.
Democrats say they won't vote to reopen the government until the Obamacare subsidies for next year are renewed. Republicans say vote to reopen the government first, then we'll talk about the subsidies. KFF says without the subsidies, premiums on the Affordable Care Act exchanges will soar 26% or more next year. Last night in 60 Minutes, President Trump said Obamacare should be fixed, although he didn't say how.
We should fix that. We should fix it. And we can fix it with the Democrats. All they have to do is let the country open and we'll fix it.
Trump didn't say he had a new plan for health care. He also wouldn't commit to bringing Democrats to the White House to negotiate. Instead, he said he wasn't going to be, quote, extorted by Democrats who, quote, have lost their way. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Expect more delays to flights with air traffic controllers ordered to keep working without pay with the government shutdown. Some seem less inclined to come in for extra shifts, for instance. Yesterday, one of the New York City airports, Newark Liberty, was a particular mess. U.S. national security concerns may get in the way of your next car purchase. It's about getting enough microchips. This after the Trump administration expanded trade restrictions on some China-based companies, including one called WingTech, which in turn owns a company headquartered in the Netherlands called Nexperia that might now have trouble supplying low-tech chips for cars and trucks worldwide. Marketplace's Carla Javier has that.
The chips in question aren't the most cutting edge, says Sam Fiorani of Auto Forecast Solutions.
These chips operate secondary parts of the car, like power windows or things like that, non-crucial parts. However, components themselves are crucial to the vehicle in selling a vehicle.
Because, he says, you can't sell a car without all the parts.
it could halt production in a number of places, and it is already slowing production in plants in the United States and across North America.
That's because car makers can't easily or suddenly switch chip providers, says Aaron Keating at Cox Automotive. There are testing and regulation requirements they have to follow. She says most automakers use the chips, so some will lean on stockpiles. But if those run out,
they're going to have to make some tough decisions and likely prioritize more profitable models to be sure that they keep the inventory of those models and also fast-selling models in production.
Keating says there's a decent supply of cars on dealership lots for now, but that won't last forever.
All of it, at the end of the day, puts the consumer at risk of not having the choice on the lot that they're looking for.
So she says buyers should shop early and try to keep their options open. I'm Carla Javier from Marketplace.
Let's do the numbers. S&P futures are up 0.3%. NASDAQ futures are up 0.6%. Dow futures, I see, are up just slightly. The 10-year interest rate, pretty steady, 4.09%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com.
Now to hunger in America, with officials scrambling to get some food stamp or SNAP payments to people after the government shutdown caused that money to start drying up over the weekend. That affects millions of people, and now U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent says a method to get food assistance out to people could get worked out by Wednesday of this week, this after federal courts said the administration has to tap into emergency funds to get this done. Let's get a snapshot of one state where nearly a quarter million got food stamp benefits last year. That's about 1 in 13 people. Sylvia Blaine is CEO of the Arkansas Hunger Relief Alliance. I asked her how that network of food banks and other food security organizations is coping.
Well, we are going to do what we've already been doing. The Charitable Food Network in Arkansas, which is six Feeding America food banks that cover all 75 counties in the state of Arkansas, as well as our nearly 600 pantry and feeding site members across the state, have already been seeing a huge rise in the need because of the federal shutdown and the furloughed employees. And so SNAP provides 9 meals for every one the Charitable Food Network is able to provide. And I don't see us being able to rise to meet that need in spite of how much we would like to.
Yeah, I'm just sitting with that statistic for a second here. 9-to-1 ratio. I mean, your network can't go out and find that much food and build the logistics networks to replace SNAP.
Right. I mean, that would take expanding our warehouses, expanding our food storage capacity, refrigeration, freezing, transportation capacity, and doing that on a dime at a time when most of the nonprofit world has been facing budget cuts.
Taking a look more broadly at the demographics of hunger, what are some of the largest groups that are eligible for benefits? I would start with probably people with children, right?
Certainly. So more than 70% of the people in this state receiving benefits are households with children. And I'd also like to point out that it's above 73% of the people receiving SNAP benefits in the state of Arkansas are also employed.
More urban or more rural?
No, it's across the board. We are number one in food insecurity. So we have a good amount of food insecurity in our urban and our rural populations. And we have food deserts in every single county.
How do you think it's going to be playing out in the coming days if they don't resolve this government shutdown? I mean, longer lines at food pantries?
Yes, the longer the lines, the more chance we risk of running out of food to be able to meet this need. And I think it's also important to remember that we're facing this going into the holiday season. And so, you know, many of our food banks are currently distributing the food that they typically stockpile for the Thanksgiving and Christmas season. So unless we're able to get this resolved and resolved quickly, we could be looking at a pretty bleak holiday season.
Sylvia Blaine is CEO of the Arkansas Hunger Relief Alliance. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And in Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio. You're listening to the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
It is a minute before 6 o'clock. Good morning. You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in Northern Minnesota. We invite you to join us at kaxe.org. You can click the donate button to become a member. We also have lots of local stories for you to check out. 1 hour from now, we'll have a special edition of the Up North Report, local news from our region. Weather today, sunny, highs near 50, breezy west winds, and tonight, mostly clear, lows near 30. For tomorrow, partly sunny, highs in the low 50s. At 7:45 this morning, another installment of What We're Reading. Tammy Bobrowski talks with Grand Rapids Area Library Children's Librarian Tracy Campa about new and noteworthy books for kids.